Ms. Vanderbilt, you, obviously being a very decorative young lady and involved with fabric and color design initially, you were asked to do all sorts of public relations chores for the design staff and for the company. And you've told me some of them. We've noticed that you and your fellow female designers were, I mean, your sister female designer, there I go again.
Your
Chauvinist. Sister, yeah, right. Your sister designers were obviously in demand at several points during your career to come up with some sort of, I mean, to be involved in some sort of public relations campaign to, a promotional campaign to convince the world that General Motors was very forward-thinking, and you did have the female consumer in mind. You indicated that you found these a bit trying and demanding, and but on the whole, I think you must feel now that this was a pioneering effort, and you were involved with something from really groundbreaking activities.
Well, yes, it was groundbreaking. To get back to one of your earlier statements, what distressed most of us was that we could never be identified as just designers. We were always the la femmes, or we were the female designers, and that we were designers, and men were designing for women long before we came along, and I think that's what rubbed us a little. It was a matter of making something of the industry as well as the person. And I think it's wonderful. We had a terrific exposure. I'm sure that for GM it was a good exposure too. But as a designer, we designed the same as the men did. And as I mentioned, it's intuition that we might have had, how we might intuitively feel about something.
Mm-hmm.
Naturally, maybe our feelings about seats and doors and instrument panels and steering wheels and the like maybe had a different flavor, but that's why you employ more than one designer from one background, from one school.
Right.
We all had our responsibilities, and I think eventually found our particular interest. And I love the sports cars.
Mm-hmm.
I drive them,
mm-hmm.
and I had a feel for that. I also like the other end of the scale, the elegant, very classic-looking
right.
cars in the Cadillac range. Mm-hmm. No way did I have much feeling for the basic Biscayne at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, let's get it done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when it came to the Corvettes or to the Camaro, more time was spent on it because we had a little more money to. The Cadillac, I recall at one time, after being in Chevrolet, where they said, I don't know, it's going to cost a penny more. And I was astounded at a penny in those days. When I got to Cadillac, also in Chevrolet, they said, you're going to have to take $25 out of this door.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, we don't have $25 in this door.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there was much laughter. But when I got to Cadillac, the one time I thought, boy, this is a place for me. You know how women love to spend money.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, I think on this particular line, which would have been the top of the line, the Eldorado perhaps, they said, let's put some more money into it. Well, you can imagine what I felt about that. So all that Cadillac was a pretty good place to work.
It must have been a great time.
And I think from that point of view, if you had said to a man, let's spend more money, his feelings would have been the same, although maybe I would have used it in a little different manner.
Since you were, in a sense, relegated to interiors, and I don't mean that in any condescending sense, but you had a love for sports cars, did you ever get involved in any of those remarkable things that Larry Shinoda did for Bill Mitchell, any of those Mako Sharks or any of the...
Those were usually assigned to as a special project. Yes, I I would, from time to time, maybe be consulted about it, but we did it as a studio. I didn't do it as an individual.
I see.
No, those, you see, that you had to be careful of, because that, again, was the male image of...
Well-preserved.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
You don't want to tread on that.
It wasn't until several years later they got ladies inside the thing.
That's right.
Well, this whole mystique of... It amazes me, and I've gone through it, and over my lifetime, a whole mystique of ladies being, in effect, second-class citizens in terms of abilities, in terms of, as you say, intuition in terms of being able to handle what has heretofore been a male preserve. You've been all through this, you know, more than you must. What are your reflections on that?
Well, I think the old theory of women were taught, and when I was going to school, in a different manner. Men played baseball, and girls played with, you know, other things. Fortunately or unfortunately, I did take part in group activities, and mostly with boys, because there was only one other girl in the neighborhood. So I learned very fast the rules of group decision making.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And maybe that helped, because we're told now that the reason some women do not do well in business is because it's always a one-on-one rather than as thinking in terms of a group.
Mm-hmm.
I understand now, because my little niece Kimberly, who is 11, is now being taught to work with groups.
Uh-huh.
And to take the best of each area and say, come up with your project together, not
mm-hmm.
by yourself.
Okay.
And we always were into do it yourself. You know, you do your own thing.
Right.
And only because I did play baseball and football and soccer and whatever else, maybe I learned some of the team effort
mm-hmm.
that is required to come out with the goal at the end. Designing is a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, I had to learn even more about that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was a handicap for me or not, I don't know. But I think you still have to be conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very hard. It was hard for me to consider this as a group.
Mm-hmm.
And we all had our separate assignments, but the end result all went into the same car, so you had to know what each person was doing. And certainly there were days when three or four of us would cover the walls with just door designs.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to that, it would be just steering wheels. And I thought, this is not right. We should be thinking of the car in total. And that's when George Moon got us, so that we would design and sketch with the whole interior rather than just one part.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not answering your question directly, except that I think most women now are more used to maybe the team effort
mm-hmm.
than I was.
There's no more. There probably were early adversarial situations, but you were able to surmount them with common sense and a sense of the fact that you were not a loner, you were part of a team, and that you had to put up with certain things to make the end result.
Yet it was still nice, if you could do it, is stand back and say, I did that.
Yeah.
But more often than not, it was 10, 12 people that were doing it.
Yeah, I've gotten the feeling from designers that I've interviewed that you see things going down the road in pieces.
Yes.
You say, oh, that was my rear end, that was my tail.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
It's too bad, but the project is too big to do it alone. Now, the overall concept, again, goes back to brainstorming and, you know, lots of sketches, and we would decide which one looked the best, but the bosses decide that.
Yeah.
And then the trouble starts. It's when they'd say, well, I like the front end or the tail end of that. Please put that with the side. And interior designers were the same way.
Really?
No, that seat won't look good with that door. Well, you make it look good because we like the concept, and then we would do it.
Well, the Branch Out Show was quite a milestone in interior thinking, design thinking, was it not?
Yes.
Did that really sort of either presage or implement an explosion of new thinking, a new idea, a new concept in interior design?
I think it did launch it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, you can't have that go on and on. We did have a subsequent show, I believe, after that, that had more of what I would call more electronic gadgetry and what's new,
mm-hmm.
you know, to try to incorporate it into the instrument panel area, so it wasn't just trim. The hard part about that is that if you're in a production studio, you're so tight for time
mm-hmm.
that unless somebody puts it down on the desk and said, here, you can use this now just the way it is, it's very hard to get time to make it work and get it into the production aspect. So in a way, yes, a lot of it came out. There's a lot that came out of that, but it was quite watered down.
Was it?
Yeah, and I can't give you absolutes, but unless someone wanted to pay for a real suede, let's say, there were things we had to do to it that after a while didn't look like suede, it was something else. We had to find something else that was cheaper, that would pass all of the tests that we have, that withstood the staining and wear and tear of just getting in and out of the car, and as you say, the slidability wasn't there, and on. And that's just one thing. If we could just take something like that, develop it, and then, drop it on the desk of a production studio designer and say, here, that we're ready to go, now you work with that. You see, it would took lots of time to develop some of those things. But I'm sure George Moon feels the way I did. If we hadn't done it, we'd still be dragging our feet somewhere. We really yes. did make an impact with that. And not just for the designers, but for everyone else. The representatives of the various companies that serve General Motors.
Did you have a lot to do with the suppliers?
Yes, we worked probably every other day. There was a supplier in that would be showing either fabrics or trim, metal plates, any kind of textural materials that we could use on the instrument panel, soft ones, hard ones, you name it. And many times we would have the inventors from those companies bring us things that were outrageous, but working together we were able to come up with some new ideas for fabrics that no one else had used. And we were always quite proud of the fact, and there will be others that will refute this. I feel it, and certainly not any of my doing, but I still feel that we pressed more for the new things than some of the other companies, because I also was able to see, after we had introduced a fabric, put it on the car, we also saw similar things in Chrysler and Ford.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think we led the pack in many areas.
So, General Motors interiors were always ahead of everybody else.
Well, and we don't need to say that just because, you know, happy General Motors. It isn't that at all. It's just I really believe that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they look better. Now times have changed.
Well, with you and Moon and Schwartz, I think you had quite a team there, quite a forward-looking team.
I had a great deal of respect for both of them, as I did and still do, of George Angersbach, and I worked with Bob Carr. My last assignment was with him primarily when my time was limited, and I worked almost entirely on new things. I would try to feed information back to the production studios, and all of them, not just one in particular. But that was an accommodation for me and for my situation. And again, I was very grateful to Ted Moon. At that time, I reported really to Ted Moon,
mm-hmm.
and very grateful for the opportunity to work that closely with a man who didn't say no every time you turn around. He'd say, yeah, let's do that, let's try it, or do you know how to do that? I'd say, no, but we'll find out.
He was always amenable.
Oh, yes, yeah, a very fine guy.
The fabric at that time became very popular with velour. Did you have any hand in that at all?
I believe that evolved out of the furniture suppliers. They had velour and took a long time to develop it, but we did develop some special fabrics for special cars that I did with Cadillac, for Cadillac, and the forerunner of their special cars that are coming out. And we were never able to get the exact look we wanted, but there was one in particular where we asked them to take a velour, a cut velour, and then put a design down in it. So that it had, and it's hard to describe without it, but it had essentially little dots, but they were actually little gold medallions of some sort.
Really?
I can't recall what it was. Probably part of the Cadillac emblem. And that was a special thing, and it took a long time to develop, but we made them do it, and they did.
These
special
were the mills,
cars.
The mills,
mm-hmm.
people who also worked with, you also worked with exotic new dyes as well.
Well, on one of our projects later on, we had a gal, it's in one of these books, Jan Tribby, who had more information on these dye transfers than anyone else.
Yeah.
And when we had a special...
What's her last name?
T-R-I-B-B-E-Y. I believe she's in New York now, but I don't know where.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a project to do a bicentennial car that would have, for 1976, and I think it was, and we had a just to get an idea. Barbara Munger came up with a replica of an old American quilt appearance, and how do you, how in the world do you get that look?
Mm-hmm.
And we had it, the three of us worked on that car, and you'll see it in the folder. And I felt that it was a wonderful team effort,
mm-hmm.
but somebody had to coordinate it, and I got that lucky job.
Mm.
And the others really did the work.
Uh-huh.
But then we had to sell it, and I loved selling.
And was it accepted?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There were a lot of things that were accepted. For example, we had, during this time when I was doing my own thing, so to say,
mm-hmm.
we did four Chevettes. And this was the beginning of having image cars. In other words, making sure that the cars had something to say, so
mm-hmm.
they didn't all look the same.
Mm-hmm.
And one car was called Sandpiper at my urging. It just seemed right for a little yellow car. We
mm-hmm.
had a special interior. We even designed, or I did, we even designed the advertising campaign. We showed them what photographs to use, set up the display for a the dealership, the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the logo was designed by our people, but I don't know where it went.
Went down some executive waste.
Well, I think they had one or two of them, pardon me, but they didn't do it right. They didn't, you know, you can promote just about anything.
Yeah.
But if you don't do that, it's like the record industry, you know. If you don't hear it, you can't vote on it. Oh, dear.
What are the breakthroughs that came through at this point in terms of fabrics and colors?
Well,
I asked you before, did you get caught up in the Naugahyde period, or was that pretty much relegated to the lower end of the line?
Well, I don't remember. I'd have to look at our photographs, but it seems to me there were other ways of printing on that, and we were punching holes in it to make it breathable.
You're right, exactly.
And that kind
that
of
helps.
Thing.
Yeah.
And that evolved out of some of that, but it's been so long ago that you're asking me technical things that I've long forgotten because we take them for granted now.
Yeah, right. Well, you did have bread and butter fabrics that you used every day. The broadcloth, the basic broadcloth.
Mm-hmm.
And you talked about suede. I seem to recall that suede had a brief run in popularity at the time.
Well, what I did is I went to New York one time and I saw a coat made out of ultra suede.
Mm-hmm.
This is when they first brought it out. And I bought one and then brought a, I think I sent a sample to my boss, and he said, well, we'll wait till you get back.
Is that George Moon?
No, that was George Angersbach at the time.
Angersbach. How did you spell his last name, by the
way? A-N-G-E-R-S-B-A-C-H. And
he was the Chevrolet man?
Yeah, he was in Chevrolet, but I'm trying to think if he was at that time the chief or the assistant. I don't recall. Doesn't matter, except that I just said, this is our answer,
mm-hmm.
and if we can wear it, why can't we sit on it?
Sure.
And it's washable,
mm-hmm.
and on and on. Well, you wouldn't believe what I had to go through.
It's convincing.
Yeah, because that fabric, that particular fabric, as I recall, wouldn't stand up under the tear test that Fisher Body had at the time. It does tear. Or you could put a hole in it easily, and so on. And so, not too long after that, they developed some synthetics that were close, but didn't look the same. And sometime later, the furniture industry got a hold of it. And as you can see, I've used it, and it's on that stool over there. And and that's ultra suede. And I said, well, if Halston is using it for his Halston, the designer for
H-A-L-S-T-O-N.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
he's a fashion designer. He was making a bundle on his luggage.
Mm-hmm.
So he put this, whatever grade it was, on his luggage, and I tried to sell that. I said, it certainly is going to be better than the clothing
mm-hmm.
variety. Well, I don't know whatever happened on that one, but we sure tried. You beat your head against the wall. Another thing that was popular at that time was printing fabrics with Gucci everything. Mm-hmm. Do you recall that?
Yes.
It's beginning to come back to me now as to the various things that we tried to propose. And Gucci always had his little red and green stripe, and then... Anyway, Bob, was it Lund? He was he was general manager at the time that I had one of these big shows. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And I was doing the interiors for Chevy at the time, and I tried to promote a printed fabric that had the Chevrolet logo on it, but very, very subtle, mm-hmm. on beige, with a particular stripe on the seat, and I had the luggage that went with it and everything, and he felt that was free advertising, and I thought, why not?
Of course.
And that went down the tubes. And it's too bad, because everybody was excited about it. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a canvas feel to it. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, when you think about it, how many of those did just sort of go by the wayside? There was nothing wrong with it. It was different.
What are the bread and butter fabrics of today?
Do you know? I don't know, and I don't look. I know that
what were they when you retired?
That's a long time ago. 77?
Yeah.
It's almost 10 years.
Probably had an advantage too.
Velour is what I have in the car that I bought.
Velour is still very popular, huh?
We had some knits that I suppose were considered to be...
What about those metallic knits? Were they...
Do you know? I don't remember them.
Yeah.
If I had time to think more about it, I've put it out of my mind. I don't really... I can't tell you. I know that there were many, many innovative things that we were doing, but somehow they don't... it doesn't seem as important as the design of it.
Well, you're in... you had the Branch Out show, and in March of 71, you become what you've wanted to be for a long time, chief designer.
No, I didn't want to, remember?
You didn't want to be an administrator.
No, I didn't.
But you didn't refuse it.
I couldn't refuse it.
It was an offer you couldn't refuse.
Well, there were some, it certainly was a monetary situation.
Yes, you must have gotten a large jump in pay.
Not a huge jump, no, but it was enough so that I could finally buy a condo.
Ah, yes.
And I thought, for nothing else, I had to get out away from the railroad tracks.
Royal Oak, still in Royal Oak at that time?
Yeah, I had never moved. I couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I sold all my GM stock, as I recall, to make the down payment.
Mm-hmm.
And I worried about whether I could make it or not.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there were many reasons, and the other is, purely from a design point of view, is that I thought I could maybe, as being the chief designer, push a little harder for the things I believed in.
Right. So what does the chief designer do, or what did he do in March of 71? What were your duties? How did they shape up during the day?
Well, we usually had morning meetings every morning with whoever was the, at that time, probably early on, it was with Don Schwarz, and he felt it was important for him to know what was going on and for us to know in turn.
Was he chief stylist at
Chevrolet? Yeah, he was head of the Chevrolet area.
You had one studio?
Yes, I just had one studio. Drew Hare had the other.
Who was that?
Drew Hare, H-A-R-E. He's now chief designer of Cadillac Interiors. So we essentially,
what's his first name?
Drew, D-R-E-W. So we worked together, and we went to the meetings and came back to the studios, usually. And this was all early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And
designers get up early.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you come home late. And usually we would have our day planned ahead of time. I remember carrying a lot of 3x5 cards around, because mm-hmm. you'd meet people in the hallway, and
right.
you'd get another assignment or a change.
That's a leading question.
Usually it's a matter of getting back with your own people. And it's like very typical, I would think, of any other business situation.
Mm-hmm, sure.
But it was tight because of timing. We were always working to a deadline, always schedules.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it was a matter of assigning the projects for the day, and maybe
right.
something had changed from yesterday, so mm-hmm. we had to get the troops going on something else. And
what did Chevy 2 take up? Was it interiors only?
Well, Chevy 2 meant the total car. Not just interior.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So for the first time, you're sort of released.
Well, that's what I meant before, is that I didn't get to actually design an instrument panel myself, but you know, to do it and have it approved.
Yeah.
But as a chief designer, you're able to direct that, and maybe that was the way it should have been. I don't know. And I had excellent assistants and lots of good designers working for me and engineers, and we pulled it through. And then there are programs for instrument panels. They're all set up, so maybe you don't have to redesign it totally one year to the next. You know, they carry over a lot of
but
things.
You can add finishing touches to it.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, but in the old days, again, we change things all the time. Now it's, I don't know what the length of time it is, whether it's 4 years or 5 years. It used to be every two.
Used to be about 18 to 24 months, 18 to 36 months.
But it's hard to tell a day. It was trying. We had personnel problems. We would have to make maybe decisions on color that day, and it would rain, so what do? You make adjustments to that. We had shows that we put on. We had actual designs and thinking. It was a fast, fast pace. There was really no break at all. It was just constant.
Mm-hmm.
Best I could do was pick up a color chip and walk the hall if I felt I needed to. But it's hard for me right now to sit down and think about what a day was like then, because I've put it out of my mind. I have other things now that I prefer to do, and I've pretty well forgotten about it. And it's too bad, but I don't care anymore. It was a terrible time at first, but now it's so different. It isn't the same.
But what during this period when you were chief designer for Chevrolet No. 2, what stands out in your mind as the sort of thing you can look back to with some degree of some objectivity that turned out well?
That I made it through, I guess. And I really didn't. I feel that I never really, this is a negative, but I don't feel that I really ever made it, or I would have had a bigger load rather than just Chevrolet 2. I was not well, and I realized even then that I probably would not last. I think women are geared in general, and maybe a lot of women today are not that way, but I think my generation was not geared for the long haul. But perhaps for that short spurt of energy, like a 50-yard dash, and then that's it. I think I still think that men are more geared to the long, long haul. And I'd be very interested to see if some of the women that are there now will be there to retire.
Uh-huh.
If they are, I wonder if they will have been chief designers for any length of time, because it's very draining.
Terrible responsibility.
Well, it's in any job, it doesn't matter whether you have two people or 100 people working for you. I think it's how you, what your general makeup is for them.
If I read this correctly, that it's Chevrolet Interior Number 2, where there are two interior studios and two exterior studios?
I think that's the way it worked, yes, because we had the small cars and the big cars, and they broke both of those up because the volume of work. The work changed from time to time, and they had to employ more people for a greater number of body styles. Now I don't know what they're doing.
Someone apparently decided you had predilection for small cars at this point.
I hope so, because I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Which ones do you recall? The Chevette was one of your
Well, that was one, and
projects.
Yeah, we got that from Opel, and then we had to hurry up and put an interior in it.
Mm-hmm.
But the Camaro and the Nova, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the third one at this point. I probably have it somewhere. And certainly the Corvette. I don't remember at what point we got involved in that. At one point we were doing the interiors, and another point Drew Hare was doing actually the Corvette instrument panel, but I was helping out doing interiors. It was and sometimes it was a dual role where Drew at one point was doing all of the hardware, and I was doing all the soft trim in order to break it up even more. So we leaned on each other, and again, because of illness, they had to keep changing this around. But I don't think that I would have survived there as an administrator. I just prefer to do it myself.
Did you protest that you were not an administrator?
No, I think that was pretty evident. and but there was nothing they could do about it because of the money situation. Yeah, they had to do that. Now I hope they've learned their lesson that people who are good at what they do should be paid for that and leave it and not try to. I went to management school and that was fine, except that it wasn't. It didn't relate to design staff at all. It was for managers of huge, what's the word? Well, like a huge drafting room, for example, where you have hundreds of people. Yeah. Or
Ms. Vanderbilt, if we could ask you to give us some. You are now chief designer of Chevrolet Interior Number 2, and that in that instance encompassed the small car line pretty much, did it not?
Yes, yes.
And you worked on many of the GM small cars of that era, and in your chronology you have a 2 or 3 years later you become the design assistant. How did that come about? What was the reason for that?
Well, that was to make accommodations for the limited time that I had through doctor's orders to work.
You had developed a disability which cut down on your time and
yes,
stamina.
That's right. Yeah. And they advised only 4 hours of work a day. So it was almost impossible for me to carry out production
scheduling.
Right. And this was to accommodate that. However, as in any job, many times things were made for you, like scheduling was done for you, and it would maybe 6 hours or 7 hours that I was there, and I realized that I couldn't work on a 4 hour schedule.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And as a result, I left. I resigned.
But that was 3 years before you decided.
Well, I gave it my all.
Yeah.
But when you're taking chemotherapy, it was very hard to do and makes you ill.
Who was the person who set this up for me? Who was this understanding?
Well, Ted Moon, George Moon. Mm-hmm. I call him Ted. He's
yeah,
known as
George Moon,
George,
right.
Or Ted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I have to thank him over and over again because there was a time when I asked if I could be excused for a while to write a book about design.
Mm-hmm.
And that was turned down by Tom Christensen, unfortunately, because I think if I'd had time to breathe for a while, I would have gotten over this treatment and maybe could have come back and continued to work in an advanced design situation. But as many other things, they didn't foresee that this was going to be so incapacitating for me, and I realized it would be, so I told George that I felt that I couldn't continue on. And that was unfortunate, but for me, I think it probably saved my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I'm here to continue to bug everybody. Not literally, but I'm able to continue to do what I like to do.
These 2.5 years, almost 3 years, when you were in charge of interior software and development for all car lines, must have been a rather all-consuming job.
Well, it was, but I think that it was not perhaps as difficult as in a production studio. I was able to set up my own studio, my own warehouse, so to say, and I did have an assistant at that time. It was Kathy, and Denick Wagner, and she worked with me for a little while. And we were doing special cars and trying to motivate the production people as much as possible. But it's not something that everybody can do. You have to have a lot of patience with that because many times the proposals that we made might take months to develop. And that meant working very closely with the vendors. And studios need things now, not yesterday.
Right. So
it's hard for me to reflect on that. It was not a happy time. I felt pressured most of the time.
Did you? Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Although under the benevolent supervision of George Moon, there still were things you felt you had to get done, had to complete under a semi-deadline.
Yeah, yes. And he provided the time and was very generous with his time because there were times when we discussed things and took time to develop something that was right, not just push it together and put it out, and, you know, without a lot of thought. Mm-hmm. Yet there was a lot of thought involved. And I'm sure we could get into all of the innovations and all of the different things, but those things are written down, they're photographed, they're on tape, or now we have many, many slides, and those are things that will last, and I think perhaps those things will be remembered, but I think it's the person that should be remembered rather than maybe the work sometimes, because the, you know, if you drive down towards Toledo on the old highway, there are 3 miles of crushed cars, and that's my work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they dig up Detroit, it'll be rust.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little hard to take, too, when I first realized that we're in a throwaway society. And once you realize that, you make life a lot easier for yourself. You don't protect everything unless it's in the Ford Museum.
Well, we hope some of your work shows up in the Ford Museum. Mm-hmm. This is a little hard for me to do because I'll have to rely on you pretty much. We want to talk to you as a designer, as a person. How you perceived yourself as a person, as a designer.
Well, that's difficult for me to.
Well,
off the top of my head.
Blend that in with your, perhaps you have a philosophy of design.
Well, you see, design to me is not just cars, it's everything, it's
right,
a way
yeah.
of life.
Right, yeah.
And I think everything I look at has a meaning,
mm-hmm.
or and a value, not monetary, but a value.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to see things well made, well thought out, and to use the word well designed, it's a way of life rather than a job.
Mm-hmm.
And now you never lose it, it's just constantly with you.
Mm-hmm.
And whether you're playing the piano, which is part of your expression, I guess, or a harpsichord, or banging on a piece of metal in the basement, or taking a photograph, or whatever, beauty is part of my recording
mm-hmm.
of my life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can somehow enhance the world with whatever contribution you can make, and make it a better place for whatever reason, and with whatever skills you have, then that's, I feel, what I'm all about. It sounds old and trite, but to make it a better place for those people that are coming along after has always been a goal. And I think it has to do with primarily with aesthetics. What is pleasing to the eye, something that might function better than it did 25 years ago, whatever it might be. If I can design a chair or a wheelchair that is better, then that's another contribution.
Mm-hmm.
But there's just too much. I hesitate on tape to even ponder all of this because there's just so much going on in my mind, and yet it's very difficult for me to say it. I guess I'm go back to the fact that I'm better at doing things than I am talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
And my philosophy, my energy, my feelings about things are all around me. My home, the work that I have done, the work that I intend to do will change, but basically it's a respect for design. I don't know how else I can project the feeling for that, but it is my whole life.
Obviously, looking around your living room, you've retained a feeling for aesthetics.
Well, it's a mixture. It's not contemporary. It isn't Renaissance, and it isn't Victorian. But I guess I appreciate things that are well made, and whether they were made in 1875 or if they were made in 1985, it doesn't matter. It's whatever seems to be pleasing to the eye.
Did you ever feel you transcended successfully, or would have had you not been come up with a disability? Would you have transcended the
the traditional, or turned out to be the traditional role as a female designer in the Oliver Bell industry?
I don't think I would have lasted. I think there would have been a change somehow, and I would have moved on, but in another capacity, because I don't think that I would have had the physical strength, well or not, to carry on the pace, and I admit that. I just feel that I'm more of an artist than I am perhaps a geared for production.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can do it fast. Yes, you can... we used to say, yes, we can crank it out, but I think you become saturated after a while, and either a change has to be made, and obviously I made many within the company, but once you're a chief designer, you're bumping your head. There's no place to go. And either they create some place for you, or they create a new studio, or they give you a new assignment that has another title, but essentially, you know, it's the same thing. I probably would not have stayed, or I would not have lasted, and who knows? I'm very happy at what I'm doing now.
Did you ever feel that you had finally proven, in quotes, your worth as a designer, in spite of being a female?
Well, it depends on what result you expect. Whether it's respect from your fellow designers, or whether it's the product on the road that's wow, terrific.
Right.
I'm not sure that I'd ever be happy with any of those things. I think that's what makes a designer go on, is that you're never satisfied, you're constantly looking.
You're a perfectionist.
Absolutely, and I don't think anything is perfect, neither am I.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the sooner you realize that, the easier things in life is for you. My point is that we constantly look and change and hone something, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's your mind or your body, or if it's a thing, it's always looking and searching for something new and different. And I recall the days of photography when I was a youngster, just to get a clear picture was enough. And now you go beyond that stage of sketching and drawing accurate to the more abstract feeling that you get in experimentation. It's in its infancy, but I find that it moves a lot faster when you're doing it yourself than if you work for a corporation. And so from that point of view, maybe at this age, if I was still at General Motors, I would have to have been in a research situation again, where I would have to think 5 or 10 years ahead and not be within the confines of 2 years.
Did you feel that you were cribbed, cabined, and confined, that you weren't allowed to really let, there was a period there where you were in advanced studios and your flights of fancy were trimmed and cut down, mm-hmm. sometimes simply obliterated?
I don't think that's true, because of primarily it was money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet the smart ones would figure out how to do something similar for a lot less. Maybe that was Ford and Chrysler. You know, there's always that feeling of, oh, look at what they did.
Yeah.
How did they do? You had to be very, very clever. You had to make it look like it was worth a lot more than you were paying for it in Chevrolet.
You mentioned that distinctive bicentennial design that you and some of your sister designers worked on. How did that come about?
Well,
just basically, you were asked to do a special design for the bicentennial.
Yes, that's right, for a Chevrolet, and they assigned me Barbara Munger and Jan Tribby. And
had you worked with them before?
Yes, Barbara Munger worked for me when I was in Chevrolet.
Did she?
Yeah. And I don't know the reasons for the choice, except I do recall that Jan Tribby had some experience in this transfer, dye transfer of the fabric.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one thing. And the other is that we thought Barbara Munger would be good at coming up with some new ideas for this, because we were saddled with the production end of things.
She was an up-and-coming designer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I recall, I don't think she was an assistant. She might be an assistant now, but I don't remember. Yeah.
But I mean, you liked her work.
Yes, we tried very hard to promote her work, and I think she's one of those, and she could refute this, but I sense now that perhaps she is one who would rather stay on the board and do her work, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that she has any aspiration to be a chief designer. But it's more complicated than that. There are technical things about this whole mm-hmm. business that
yeah.
Working with people is certainly not easy, and especially I don't know how they felt about working for a woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the women working for women may be something you'll have to ask them, and I'm sure they'll either tell you the truth or I will know.
You have, of course, at all the same condition exists at Ford too, where you have a long entrenched kind of bureaucracy. In the case of two of the men you mentioned, have been there since the late 40s, early 50s, and have. And so you have a sort of an entrenched outlook, which, if I may say, in the current, the last 10 years of General Motors design has been a bit stodgy, to say the least. So you're probably also working against not only stereotypes, which persisted despite protestations to the contrary, you are also sort of battling an entrenched, rather old-fashioned outlook.
Well, and you must remember that there are no designers at the top of the corporation. They're all either engineering
yeah.
or financial.
Right.
Nothing wrong with that, except that more and more and more, I think, design staff is becoming secondary, and
yeah.
yet they don't realize how important this is to their sales.
Yeah.
And for that, I feel very sorry. I think there should be some women up there. I think there should be some men. I don't care if they're just consultants. That
sure.
would be delightful to
yeah.
be a consultant.
Great.
But somebody who really cares mm. and is interested.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to lose that if you're knocked down 20 times
mm-hmm.
for, we don't have enough money, we don't like that design, redo it, that fabric won't sell, even though you prove to them that the demographics are there. And it's a whim. It's somebody's wife who, and I have to say that honestly, sometimes
sure.
some of the wives
yeah, yeah.
have said, I wouldn't have that,
mm-hmm.
so get rid of it. And it ruins a total picture, a
yeah.
total line, because nobody knows what it's like until you lay it all out and see how many models and how many different fabrics and colors we have to present to the public. And it looks different in different colors. Each fabric changes a little bit, and you can get into the depth of the philosophy of that. And it can't be helped. It just cannot be helped. But we're fighting everybody.
mm. You're quite right. That all four major corporations, the finance men, and to a lesser extent the engineers, are really
mm-hmm.
the top people.
Mm-hmm.
And more and more so the finance people.
That's right. And product planning.
And
I
product
don't,
planning,
mm-hmm.
right, yes.
I think that's important, but we used to do our own product planning
of course.
Before they came along, and I think many times we had more of a feel for it because we knew what we wanted to present in order to fill the gap.
For a long period there, you were pretty much the corporation's, at least to the outside media, in terms of your population exposure. You did a lot of work for the corporation in terms of television and the subject of articles
mm-hmm.
and all sorts of assignments, giving lectures. I see here. You lectured to the Art Center School, and you lectured on Human Factors Symposium. Even Pratt asked you back to come back.
Yeah, several times.
I'm sure he did, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this must have been onerous, but yet personally gratifying.
Mm-hmm.
Or did you feel you were being used?
Well, the TV presentations were obviously PR.
Yeah.
I think that any kind of a lecture, for example, did, I hope, give my side
right.
and my impressions. But on the other hand, they were always to the men. In fact, one time I was asked to go to the Art Center School, and I was told that Peg Sauer and I did this.
Mm-hmm.
I think I mentioned this to you.
Yes.
And what happened there? And, oh, we were just going to talk to 8 or 10 women in industrial design, and we thought, well, that's nothing. We'll manage that okay. Bring some slides. Okay, here are some slides, they said. When we got there, it was the whole school, and that was absolutely, to me, it was far from being professional. We were certainly off guard and had not been totally prepared, and we looked like fools. And unfortunately, they did tape that whatever it was. I can't even say interview. They did a tape, yeah.
Video tape?
No, at those days.
Audio tape.
No. It's
oh,
an audio tape,
okay. Yeah.
Are you kidding? That would have been even funnier, you know, wringing your hands and holding your head.
Do you have a copy?
No, they didn't.
They didn't give you one?
No, if they did, it would be burned. But I would get frustrated because they were asked questions that we had nothing to do with. And those are the things that are unfair. For example, we went, when I gave this lecture to 600 Midwest College placement officials in Detroit, and the topic was women in design, not only did I have to write this talk, but coordinate all of the movie and the slides, but I didn't make those. They were given to me, and uh-huh. I had to work around it.
Uh-huh.
But they didn't tell me 600 people were going to be there, and they didn't tell me they were college placement officials. I could hardly talk. So, you know, it wasn't always fair, and I certainly objected to that, and I'd tell them so when I get back, and then they'd do it all over again. And maybe that was so I wouldn't, at least I'd go.
Mm-hmm.
But many times in the hallways, prior to one of these PR things, why Tom Christensen would say, well, now, Sue, do this for me. It was always a personal favor.
Right.
So what are you going to do?
Say,
no, I can't do that.
One of your earliest exposures was on national television, the Wide Wide World show.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite a breakthrough in 56, wasn't it?
Yes, that was fun.
Yeah,
we opened up the whole tech center, and it was really promoting the tech center because mm-hmm. it was so new.
Right.
And Dave Garraway at that time was probably as well known as anyone in the field. And I remember he asked me at one point, and I had about 2 or 3 minutes and to my whole presentation, and he got lost somewhere in it while we were taping.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Sue, tell me where we are. And I said, well, now you're supposed to say, and then I say, and you're supposed to, well, I didn't realize he was getting furious. And finally, one of the producers came over and nudged me and said, I think he knows where he is now.
It was just a ploy.
Well, no, he really lost his place in this whole
thing. But he found it quicker than he thought he did.
Yes, and, but there were many things like that that were fun, but again, I knew why they were doing it.
Why they were doing it, yeah. You felt vaguely exploited, but you did it because you were asked to and because you felt you wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
Many, but you were obviously furthering the image, the proliferation of the image of women in design.
But I think we'd have to go back, especially at General Motors, and see how many women came to work for us as a result of all this and when. That would be a very interesting study because I don't know what all this really did for us, for the women.
You were at the Art Center School a couple of times.
Yes, and that was not, I felt that the, who was it you're going to visit?
Strother McMinn?
Yeah. Fantastic guy, and he realized what was going on, and I had brought my taxicab study, I believe, to him. I think it was Harley Earl who came back from Europe and said, we've got to design a taxicab. And I was in charge of that little program for a while. And then the whole idea just got dropped because it ended up looking like what we have now, which is called a van. And nobody wanted to spend the money on that either, but Strother was interested in the approach and how I went about getting it and doing it. And again, it was one of those spline treatments.
Oh, yeah.
And we actually built it out of mock-ups and cardboard and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, right in the research studio.
Mm-hmm.
So he would maybe remember some of those things.
Nice.
I still feel the thinking, the reaching and grasping for new ideas is far more my interest
mm-hmm.
than the production line.
Yeah. Well, the looking at this, I must say this, the public relations outreach that you've been involved with over 30 years has been incredible. Do you see yourself as sort of a touchstone for female designers in this area? You should.
No. The only person that has really been interested in learning and talking about what happened when is Nellie Toledo, and maybe it's because she's new and she's from another country and is curious about our culture and the way people live. And I was very happy to meet her, and I hope that she will be one who will kind of carry the torch if they're, if she can do it. And I think she will. She's very strong. I think she's, I don't know a thing about her design. I haven't seen any of the design works, but I think from her attitude alone, she has the strength to do it. And
she
she's older.
She regards her as a marvelous role model. She's told me.
Well, that's very nice of her. I think that...
your career.
I think it just means that she has a definite chance at doing whatever she wants to.
I wonder if you'd be interested in this last few minutes to talk about some of your confreres in the industry. You mentioned the late lamented Margaret Peg Sauer. Tell us a little bit about her.
She was at GM when we were doing these femcar shows and worked for Oldsmobile Interiors. And innovative and certainly interested, but I don't think devoted.
Uh-huh.
Certainly not the way I was.
Not the way you were.
And I definitely, I had to do it, whereas I think some people, you know, it's a job.
Mm-hmm.
And although she did her very best, I don't think it was the kind of thing she really wanted to do for her total life.
But what she did, she was very good at.
I think she was. I think she was misunderstood. She was a bit of a rebel.
Mm-hmm.
But so are a lot of people in their own way. I think Nellie is a bit of a rebel in some ways.
Yeah.
But they need that. General Motors in those days would, oh my goodness, if you didn't wear the right clothes and look right, you were a rebel. Now, you know, it's a lot different. But I didn't know Peg very well, and she didn't stay very long. I don't remember when she left.
Yeah. How about Barbara Munger? You mentioned her.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she worked with me in Chevrolet.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I feel that although I tried very hard to promote her, it was almost as if she didn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't want something more.
Yeah.
And if, in fact, now they are paying people for what they can do at a certain level, then that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Because I realized early on that I'd have to back off. There are people that you can push and people that you can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, good or bad, it doesn't matter. Good designer, but I don't think she wants any more responsibility than she has. I may be wrong, but that's my impression.
Do you feel that you, your cancer has, obviously, you've surmounted it in a very real way, and yet do you feel frustrated that you might have gone on to greater heights had you not gotten it?
That's hard to say. We can always surmise and we can philosophize, but I hear that, quote, well, we had great plans for her, but I never heard them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after the fact and knowing she's not coming back, it's a lot easier to say that. What greater plans, I don't know, but there wasn't, I was bumping my head. I couldn't go any further anyway.
Yeah.
There, unless somebody left, there wasn't room.
Yeah.
I don't think I was prepared to do anything greater in management. I feel lucky that I'm here, and I'm lucky that I have the hobbies that I have to fall back on, because essentially I'm continuing to design. I'm just not designing cars.
Right. Okay.
And my life is full. I think that if it had to be, that maybe it was a blessing in disguise. About all I can tell.
Well, you survived. Have your hands.
Thank you.
You think that you think someone would have come up? Maybe George Moon would have come up with something like a sort of an overall styling coordinator.
Could be.
Yeah,
I had started in that direction.
You started in that direction, doing all lines,
mm-hmm.
and that
well,
seemed to
I,
be.
Yes, I wrote to him a letter and proposals of what I wanted to do,
mm-hmm.
which I thought the corporation could benefit from, and
right.
he accepted them, and we were slowly
mm-hmm.
ticking them off one by one,
yeah.
and he gave me the time and the opportunity to do it, which I will be forever grateful.
Mm-hmm.
We never quite finished. I just
had
couldn't
to
do it.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think it would have to have been something that I could control myself
mm-hmm.
at my own speed.
I have a feeling that you were probably on your way to that sort of position.
Well, who knows? Who knows?
Well, I think we can say safely, Suzanne Vanderbilt, that you've left your mark on automobile design, and certainly has a shining beacon for female designers everywhere, I would think.
pleased that you allowed us to interview you today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.